Feynman's a famous 20th century physicist, quote from him that's relevant here, and which I think he had a more acute sense of than many scientists do, is this one, that if you know the name of a given bird in 20 languages, you actually haven't learned anything about biology at all. You've learned a bit about people, because just assigning a name or learning the name other people give isn't actually in any sense a scientific explanation. It's a piece of terminology. It's pretty much the prototypical bit of surface learning. Now, these again are the other side of that second sheet in the handout. Sorry, I reproduced it upside down. Now, I need to... So the idea of deep and surface learning came out of educational work, first of all by Scandinavians and later by some Scottish academics. They talked about and collected research on strategies of learning which they observed in particular real learners. I'm instead going to talk on this slide, the left-hand side of this, about a different take, because I, again, why I think this is a very important aspect of theories in learning and teaching is because this deep versus surface or deep versus shallow contrast is actually not just about how some students learn. It's a broader connection. So I'm going to talk first, in fact, about a slightly different angle on it, which is thinking about it as a distinction between types of knowledge which you may or may not collect. And my redefinition of deep learning is about knowledge where you are making multiple connections to each new piece of information, and not just connections, as it were, of the same kind. That is, you learn the name of another bird species and link it to the first bird species by way of contrast, but different types of connection. So a deep learner is one who makes multiple types of link to a new area. And these bullet points are different kinds of link you might make, as opposed to learning this stuff in isolation or all of one kind. So one kind of thing is when you read or hear a lecture on a concept, can you generate your own examples? If you're unlucky, the presentation won't give you any examples at all. More typically, the presentation will give you one or two examples, but the question is, have you done the work to think about other examples and worked on those yourself? And that makes a big difference, because if you don't practice on that, you're extremely likely to have this sort of disconnected book learning knowledge, and when you see a case in life of the concept, you probably will not recognize it, and you won't be able to answer questions on it. And they're quite striking examples of that. So the Scandinavian example early in this tradition of the literature used an economics course. They interviewed students at the end of what the Americans would call Economics 101, an introductory course to economics, and they would ask an open-ended question, which was something like, why does a loaf of bread cost a kronan, or say a pound in Glasgow at the moment? And typically, students would answer then that this reflected the cost of flour and the cost of the baker's labour, and maybe, if they're sophisticated, the capital necessary for the machines. Now, the one thing you can tell without visiting a country is that in an introductory economics course, they're going to talk about the law of supply and demand. And those are all supply-side constraints. In other words, they'd taken no notice of that. They hadn't thought about the way the price of bread will double, triple, or more in a famine. They're just talking about the cost to the supplier. And they hadn't made any link between economics and examples of the world. And this is typical. We get the same trouble with physics students, bumping into bits of physics in life and not for a moment recognising a connection. So that would be one kind of link. Not completely unrelated to that would be linking concepts to your personal experience of relevant experiences. Quite a different kind of concept is when you hear of a concept and you're thinking as the lecturer goes on about whether other things you've learned would seem to contradict or support that. And those are likely to be links between alternative theories. So that is the difference between peri C and peri A there. But what I want to stress here is that you can be in a high peri position and still barely begun on deep learning. Deep learning is not the same, it's not even close to the same as peri. Or if you're a contrarian, as I was trained to be in school, as soon as teacher says something, I try and think of counterexamples. Please, sir, you're talking bollocks. That kind of thing. What about this? Again, another kind of link would be how relevant is this theory? Does it answer any prior questions? I don't often think about that, but it's actually an interesting and tough test to apply to an area. So, for instance, if I here think about physics, then what would a pre-scientific person think? What questions would a pre-scientific person have that they might reasonably expect physics to answer? And I think predicting whether it will rain today would be a good one. And certainly all the relevant laws are believed to be well understood by physicists, but still physicists can't really predict the weather more than a few days in advance, at least not in Britain. You can critique an area, or at least put some scale on it, by thinking about what everyday questions have always been there, which are clearly in the purview of this area of study. To what extent are they actually managing? So, you know, one from engineering perhaps would be about the invention of the wheel. We have wheels all around us. It sounds like a great invention. Engineers are very proud of it. But if you step back, you've got to ask yourself, why haven't wheels evolved in the animal world? Actually, they have two or three times, but they're really so unimportant there. Why is that? Well, basically the wheel is a nice boy's idea, but it only works on flat surfaces, so engineers' solution has been to pave over most of the world to create the environment where their wonderful invention is useful, and you plonk wheels down on an average piece of landscape, and they really don't work. You have to go to very unusual places like salt flats for normal wheels to work well. If you're thinking of dropping devices in arbitrary places, probably we need to be doing more work on walking machines, since that's actually clearly from animals a more general solution. So this other view of deep and surface is about the number of kinds of links, how deeply you've woven in the direct constructivist sense, how much construction have you done connecting these new ideas into what you already know in different ways. So the general notion of deep versus surface or deep versus shallow can be applied in different ways. So I've been giving you the first bullet point at the top right about the structure of the knowledge, about the kinds of links. You can apply it to the goal of the learner, that is, would the learner like to understand in some sense, or just to do some specific task? So a classic symptom of shallow learning is that the learner actually does very well with it, but they do it only for a specific purpose and in the context that they've learned it. And of course, that's not without its own rewards. You learn to drive a car, you generally aren't thinking about whether or not this method of guiding a vehicle will be any use if you steer a boat or fly an aeroplane. You're just doing it in this local context, and that may be entirely appropriate for the person, and it's certainly directly useful. So we can think of it partly as a different kind of learning. So very often, shallow or surface learning is directed at the test that the learner foresees they have to take, and they learn exactly what it requires to pass that test, not interested in understanding anything except to the small extent that understanding might help that. The third bullet point is a strategy a learner has, and this is what the most of the published psychological and educational literature means by deep and surface. Some interesting things out of that literature is that I'd say there are two things. One is a strategy, but the background for this is that very often teachers are horrified by the way their students learn in the sense of passing the tests, but fail in what the teacher takes for granted as understanding about that area. So it's that dissonance that probably gives you a sort of emotional push in this area, dissonance between how learners don't seem to pick up understanding along with picking up test passing ability. Now, one of the observations in this area of strategy or approaches is that it's certainly possible to design a course where all learners do surface learning because that's all that the course allows or requires. So in an old-fashioned medical training, say 80 years ago, they'd be examined on anatomy, and really that meant being able to produce one of these pseudo-Greek or Latin terms like femur for the requisite bone in the body. Of course, it's not obvious what the hell that's useful for, except to not being a doctor but a comparative biologist. It would be much better for communicating to patients to use a term like thigh bone, which everyone would understand. Saying femur simply prevents communication from doctor to patient. Of course, it greatly helps communication between people studying frogs versus humans, because a frog femur doesn't look much like a human femur, and it's a real piece of knowledge to understand there is a deep relationship there. But for doctors, probably not a smart move. So you can create a course where only shallow learning is possible or rewarded. It doesn't seem possible to create a course where only deep learning happens. But if it's possible, then you can observe that some students do and some don't, and that's why it's to some extent sensible to call it an approach. It also means, now I should say that the terminology of deep and surface is the Scottish academic terminology. It's not actually what the original work by Ference Martin and his collaborators used, and it contains a mistake, or an invitation to a mistake. First of all, because they're different kinds of deep learning. It's not either or, it's not even a one dimension. But the other is that the real thing which comes out here is that this is not it's not a trait. So to describe it as deep versus shallow learning, without saying it, it tends to induce in most readers the idea that deep is good and shallow is bad, and it's a property of the learner. But actually, better studies on learning approaches show that it's a three-way relationship between the learning context, the student, and the approach, and that students will select an approach. If they're capable of more than one style of learning, which many are, they will select the one that's either forced on them by the course or seems to suit their interests better. And therefore it's not a trait, it's about this three-way relationship. You can also attempt connections between American academic psychology concepts like Pintrich's mastery versus performant motivations, which are seem to be quite similar to deep versus surface approaches. That is, a surface approach would go for performance motivations, where what you care about is being able to do a single task you're focusing on, and a mastery one, which has a bit more to do with open-ended understanding. But another thing I want to re-emphasize is, if you take my redefinition of deep learning as about knowledge and about making more rather than fewer kinds of links, then learning is never done. There's always more types, there's more links to make. There's no end to deep learning. It's not a finite goal, it's a direction. And that, of course, doesn't suit some intuitions about learning, that there's just so much to know, and when you've learned it, you never need to spend another moment on it. But it does, of course, correspond to how, for things you're actually interested in, you may have stopped devoting a lot of time to it, but you certainly notice when you come across some new bit of information and carry on modifying and improving what you know. So you can think about a deep versus surface contrast in a variety of these ways. Of course, they're related to each other, but a lot of the literature will have taken one and not discussed the other aspects. It's even possible to think about it in terms of the type of tests. Generally speaking, I would expect longer-term retention for deep learners rather than others, but simply because, on the whole, the more links you make, the longer it takes you to completely forget something. Or, to put it another way, you've got more ways back to a piece of half-forgotten knowledge the more kinds of link you have. It'll probably almost certainly lead to better abilities to transfer it into other areas. A lot of deep learning is promoted or depends upon reflection, that is, on you searching what your mind, your memory, for what you already know, and thinking about whether this new thing has a connection. A rephrasing of surface learning could be that you don't really understand the meaning of what it is you're learning. And there's certainly kinds of learning like that. Learning to recite things where you don't really understand the words, let alone the meaning. We're certainly capable of that. And that leads me to, although overwhelmingly, probably in my usage, but certainly in the literature, deep is taken by teachers to be good and shallow as bad. And I think we should recognize that that's a partial truth. That is, that if you go to a course and all you learn is the technical terms, you haven't really understood it in any way, haven't understood the reasons, but you've learned the jargon, you are actually still in a very powerful position, and that's ever more true today with the World Wide Web. Because if, I don't know, you come across the word endometriosis, you have no idea what it means, you don't know enough Greek and Latin to try and do the philology, but within seconds you can find out what it means from Wikipedia. Whereas you can think about the position of someone who's the opposite. Suppose it was possible for an autistic Einstein to create new knowledge or to recreate old knowledge by himself, but he wouldn't have any connection with those words. So he wouldn't be able to make those connections with what other people know, with all the other evidence that other people have gathered, other arguments that people have. It's actually very powerful to have the surface learning, to the extent that surface learning usually means learning the vocabulary and not the meaning. So, although I don't think this is a sound, that's to say I haven't elaborated at the point where I'd have fun justifying it to a hostile audience, I think it's possible to start thinking about whether shallow learning is actually something special to humans that explains something about us. I had that passing thought because of reading bits in Animal Learning. So apparently when primates are capable of learning from each other, but typically they'll only pick up something that's useful, that is where they can see the usefulness of it. So they'll never pick up a routine and then discover later why it's useful. They'll only pick up a routine because they've seen the reward in advance. And you can see, therefore, that must cut their learning abilities in half, learning opportunities in half, in some sense. Whereas, and this is a very Vygotskian view really, whereas, especially as young children, we learn all sorts of things from our mothers without necessarily understanding why they're important. For instance, being trained to say please and thank you, and getting better value out of other people. But I think a child takes a long time before they'll confront an adult hostile enough for that to make a difference. Or not unrelated, perhaps, simply to learning what to fear. So one of the things I find quite interesting, really, is how the most important thing a child has to learn, really, is things which, if they try and learn from experience, they'll just be dead. They can't learn from experience because of that. So not running across the motorway, not swinging from the overhead electrics on the railway. These are things you don't learn from experience. You can't. And I think I was quite struck by that when I saw a geography documentary once, which about the coldest inhabited town on Earth. And there, a temperature of minus 60 is quite common. They have roads, of course, most of the year there's snow on them. They have lampposts. But the thing is, if you let your flesh touch the lamppost, you will be losing a large lump of flesh to get it off. You mustn't do that. But they have children not closely supervised running around the streets just like anywhere else. Now, if I think about going there, I would be seriously frightened about not understanding what I needed to know for moment-to-moment survival there. But clearly the children have picked this up. And that suggests there's social transmission that works really effectively, and it works on fairly young children. Now, in some sense, that's probably surface learning. You learn that your parents are horrified, will shout at you, perhaps hit you if you threaten to do these things, and it is for your own good, but I don't think you learn it because it's for your own good. You learn it long before you understand in any real sense why this is so important. So that's the speculation then about why perhaps shallow learning is actually very useful to us. It doesn't mean deep learning isn't better, but it does mean it may be an important part of aspects of our learning. It may just be that in universities, in intellectually oriented institutions, we should be doing better at pushing understanding, but that doesn't mean that surface learning is without value. Right, would you like a 5-minute break? Okie dokie, and then... Now, I like Lorillard's model because it integrates more aspects than any other I've come across. Although it doesn't manage to integrate everything I think is important, but it's closer to a complete synthesis. The big page in the handout reproduces the diagram on one side and the... a more convenient list of the boxes. The general shape of her theory is that a perfect teaching and learning process would have some action in every single box. The way I deconstruct this is in terms of three underlying principles. So if you just look for the moment at the diagram, you can see that the top and the bottom are symmetrical, so that's one kind of principle is about what's the difference between the bottom and the top. Another is what's the difference between left and right. And the third principle is about why is there not one or two but several activities in each of these things. So keeping that diagram and the thing in front of you, this is what I see as three underlying principles, and I'm going to talk about each of them in turn, unless I run out of time and want to skip ahead and leave you to read these slides, which are on the web. So, briefly, the first principle is to give equal weight to teacher and learner. That is, don't think learning and teaching is all about the teacher. Don't think it's all about the learner. It's actually about what she calls a conversation between them. Feedback and convergence is about not thinking that the general case is when the learner just reads something and that's that. It's going to and fro, checking out each other's meanings, and hopefully, or put it another way, giving feedback to each other. The learner's partial understanding gives the teacher feedback on what they don't understand. Teacher's correction gives feedback to the learner on what they might correct. But convergence means hopefully this will settle down eventually to converging on the same understanding. And the third principle, which is reflected in the model between top and bottom, is the idea that there are two aspects to any subject: the public, formal, abstract, terminological, conceptual description, and personal experience. And that, in her view, learning is incomplete without both of them. Okay, so, principle A, having teacher and learner. Why is this actually important to have a model like this and not some of the other stuff? Well, the naive intuition is that learning is about transmission. This would be a teacher-centered model. Even knowledge is a kind of substance that's transmitted. It doesn't matter what... doesn't matter about the learner. All that matters is the teacher. The reaction to that was constructivism and Piaget, which is a very... Piaget focused almost all his attention on the learner, almost none on what the teacher does. And actually, I think we need a balanced model, realizing that both sides are important, and if you only think about one, you're not actually going to be able to understand and describe what goes on. So, principle A about teacher and learner. It's about considering both poles of the interaction. So, if, for instance, the learner has prior conceptions which are just going to interfere with what the teacher says, then the issue is how to move the learner from their not from a blank mind, but from their prior conceptions to target the target conceptions the teacher hopes they'll acquire. Now, just because that diagram is approximately symmetric doesn't mean that teachers and learners have the same role. They don't, obviously. So we have to keep an eye on the asymmetry of teacher and learner, like the asymmetry of a journey. Where you start and where you end, that's two different kinds of place with a different relationship to the journey. In everything I say, I should say, I use the word teacher as the label for a role, not the label for a person. There's a function to be carried out here, and you should think of that as a role. You might have many humans sharing that in some teaching situations, or it might be that the teacher is actually a book. Of course, there was a human behind it, but you're interacting with a book, not the person. It's the question of the role. Now, why do you need feedback? Why do you need interaction? Why do you need iteration? That's a technical term from especially competing science. It means going around in a loop, doing something again and again until you reach some criterion that says you're okay now and can stop. Well, why do we have them? Well, first of all, learners are active and have to act, have to choose their actions. In fact, probably, really, more or less essential is for the learner to be active in some way. They may be externally active, physically writing out stuff, speaking to a peer or whatever. Sometimes that may be hidden inside their minds, but it's processing. It's processing, it's transforming what you've heard into a new form that actually seems to be possibly essential and certainly the most widespread and powerful activity. If you just listen and nod and think you've got it, it's far less likely actually to be in your mind the next morning than if you've re-expressed it. Now, if you just take dictation, that's probably not effective mental reprocessing because it doesn't involve a transformation. But re-expressing it in another format, in other words, that would be a typical successful action for learning. In fact, I once had a Maxi student who did her Maxi on mental maps. So she trained people in mental maps, and what she was expecting was to find that people who use mental maps would learn better. But in fact, the detail of the data showed that if what the students had already used was a mental map, then re-expressing it as bullet points is what brought perceptible improvements in learning, and vice versa. That is, it's redoing notes in a different format from the original content, which is powerful for learning. In the Lorillard model, in particular, draws attention to feedback in more than one direction. So feedback from the teacher to the learner is one kind, but there are an equal number of those Lorillard activities, equal number of those 12, which are about the teacher receiving feedback from the learner. Now, I'll be saying more than once, I think a defect which Lorillard doesn't acknowledge in her model is her image is always of this one-to-one expert and novice, teacher and learner, and really peers can be very important, as you've heard me say before. And her model really doesn't accommodate that. But here, talking about feedback and convergence, we just think about learners interacting and learning through interacting. Well, that interaction may be with really a teacher or expert, but it might be with peers. But most importantly, in some disciplines, especially science, it's interacting with the material world can be the important form of interaction. But also interacting with yourself which is often called reflection. So I watch quite a lot of TV documentaries, but it makes a big difference whether I spend 5 or 10 minutes in the bath afterwards trying to rehearse in my head what I actually learned or not. Now, an old-fashioned cognitive psychologist's view is that would be rehearsal, and repeating the words makes them stick more. More important, though, almost certainly, is rethinking them, making connections, reflecting, doing various operations. So one can think of reflection as interacting with oneself, but that doesn't mean you can just assume that while you're with yourself you're carrying your mind around and that will get done. You actually have to spend time, set aside time, and do it one way or another for this to kick in and be one of the interactions that develops your learning. But it fits within this overall principle of feedback and convergence, because you think about something, you think, that can't be right, I'm sure I have something different, you work on it, you work on toing and froing. That's when the improvement comes, because you can give yourself feedback if you work out what ought to connect and then doesn't seem somehow to hold together. I think I won't speak about that, but these slides are already up on the course page if you want to study them in detail. Okay, of the three underlying principles, the public versus private, or conceptual description versus personal experience, a very common, indeed, deficit in education in general, particularly a university education, is not to drive students through making these connections. Because it's much easier to supply lectures and textbooks and indeed exams on the public conceptual description. It's not so easy to promote making links with personal experience. But this applies, I think, in every discipline. So in physics, it would be, you know, you might learn at school that Newton's laws say force equals mass times acceleration. If you want to pass the exam, you learn how to manipulate those abstractions using the words like force that have a particular technical meaning in physics different from elsewhere. But there's a different sense of understanding about how it feels to apply force, or to have ways of making force visible. So, for instance, if you're thinking about the force needed to get a supermarket trolley moving, Newton's first law is really telling you you'll need most of the force will be used to get it moving, and once it is moving on a flat supermarket floor, it'll need hardly any forces. If you wanted to visualise it yourself, you can try concentrating on what you feel in the palms of your hands, or even better, take a balloon, inflate it only in a floppy way, and put the balloon between your hands and the trolley, and then you see how squashy it has to get before the damn thing will move, and then you see it hardly squashes at all and you're just keeping it moving. That's the kind of thing about working on making links. But there's nothing special about physics. So with literature, if you want to pass the exams in literature at school or university, you learn how to write essays, you learn a particular, often very detached and academic tone. But are you making the connection with the emotions you feel when you see a play that really gets to you? That would be the personal experience. In economics, I mentioned that example about connecting the law of supply and demand versus the decisions you might make about what you'll pay, or the decisions you might make about what you'll hope to get when you're selling something. In zoology, it's probably the difference between bird watching versus studying taxonomy. In psychology, it's the difference between having lectures on short-term or working memory versus not being able to hold a phone. Well, that's an old-fashioned thing, old-fashioned example, holding a phone number in your head, but I'm sure you can come up with more modern things, such as I have trouble remembering the price I've seen on an item in one supermarket by the time I've walked down the road to look elsewhere. I just haven't got it in the head anymore. Okay, so that was a flash through those principles, but I found them persistently generative of ideas about how to critique courses and so on for what they do and don't have. I'm just going to emphasize for a slide or two reflection. There's actually quite an extensive literature on reflection, and there's a lot of distinctions made in some of it. And you may particularly meet this if you go on to do a postgraduate training course of various kinds, probably a social work course or many medical courses, require practitioners of any kind to reflect on their experience, by which I think they mean to take a critical incident from their life and think about it and work out what lessons they might draw from it. Because, of course, when you're in the heat of the moment, stopping a bleed or whatever, dealing with a hysterical patient, it's not the time when you can stop, look up the textbook, work things out. But if you want to get value out of your experience, reanalyzing it afterwards will probably slowly but surely make you, as they say, more reflective, but really have stronger connections between your conscious rational understanding of the issues and what that feels like to you in practice. So the different theories of reflection say somewhat different things, but I'm just emphasizing to you that it's an area in the literature. You can't rely on reflection meaning exactly the same thing in each paper, but it's definitely important. This is just one particular model. You'll find others. Now, Lorillard introduced it. Well, no, she used this word, mathemogenic. Students hate it because they don't instantly understand it. Comes from Rothkopf's 1970 paper. But the point is that Lorillard's model is entirely expressed in terms of 12 activities. 12, and all of which are supposed to be separately important for the best learning. One of the troubles with the Lorillard model is how to interpret those activities. So are they physical? Well, are they physical things that the teacher organizes? Are they at least observable things which the learner does, like some of you are writing notes? Or can you do it in your head? And is that the important interpretation? I have to say, I think what matters is what you do in your head, but that makes it hard to apply as an empirical theory because you can't see what's going on in people's heads. So how are you going to report the data? How are you going to collect the data? And why this matters is because I think it really is true that for a significant number of students, some of those activities, certainly by the time they're in the fourth year, they really have internalized. And therefore, it's not necessary to have external organized learning activities. One of the ways in which I've used, and would recommend you to use if you continue interest in this area, use Lorillard's model, is to take a course design, maybe one you've put on or one you wish to critique, and go over Lorillard's 12 activities and ask, is this provided for in this course? And if it isn't, is there a good reason that is? It's reasonable to believe for these students on this course they'll do that themselves without external prompts or not. In fact, there are probably almost no courses that really support all 12 activities, even implicitly. But as I say, I think one of the great values of Lorillard's theory is it is a way to structure doing a critique of a course design. And you may well modify the design you had in mind in order to have something explicit in the course to support the missing activity. Now, I'm not saying he did it using the Lorillard model, but I can tell you how impressed I was when I saw it was part of a science education group in this university some years ago, and one of the people who'd attend was a school teacher by trade, but he got a little consultancy writing instructional materials for safety practices in chemistry labs in the university. Now, the government approach to that used to be you reproduce a section of the relevant legislation in tiny print and put it up on a bloody great poster on the wall. And that could not be less, I mean, The concepts are there, but is that what even a super bright chemistry postgrad needs? Not really. What they need is to be able to see a photograph of a typical chemistry lab and point to, well, first of all, decide whether there's any safety issues not properly catered for, and if so, where they are. And a chemistry lab will have its kind of order, but basically it's unbelievably cluttered. So it's not like there'll be a cartoon with two figures in it and you can pretty much work out what the point was. It's learning to recognise those things in practice. In other words, that's about the Lorillard principle of combining the abstract knowledge with your personal experience, that is, converting a concept originally expressed in words into a perceptual recognition procedure and also into a behavioural issue. So that's a kind of way in which one can employ this theory to help you really analyse a course and its possible weak points. But as I say, it's not completely easy because some activities really will be done invisibly internally in some cases. Now, because it's an important theme in this course, and also because it's the most important defect in the Lorillard model as expressed by her, I'm going to introduce two things not dealt with explicitly in the Lorillard model and suggest they interconnect. Okay, so first of all, despite what she's said, I think she really hasn't got the idea that peer interaction is in some ways fundamentally different from interaction with a teacher, and that this matters, and you probably want both. Now, I'd like you to turn back to the handout and this table. And this is important generally, as well as belonging in this section of the lecture. What I've done here is think about the general question in my mind was, what are the varieties of ways in which a learner gets help from other people? And I've tried to expand, so keep that open in front of you. I've tried to expand these. Sorry, PowerPoint here's not behaving. There are four dimensions there. So one is whether the person you're getting help from is an expert or not. So obviously one of the things you often hope for from a teacher is that they really know their stuff, and you don't. With a peer, that's not the case. And so you have a different kind of interaction with different pluses and minuses. So the gradient of expertise is an issue. I call it gradient because there are some learning designs where you definitely see a gradient. So, for instance, you go to a judo class or a scuba diving class, and typically there'll be one expert organising it, but you have to do a lot of the work in pairs. And typically the way those classes are organised, when you come in as a novice, you'll be paired with a student who knows considerably more than you. And so there's a real sense in which there's a gradient of expertise in the classroom, that the design relies on there being that gradient and attempts to work with it and exploit it. So in the diagram, this is the major top to bottom dimension is expressed about whether there's definitely different expertise or whether there's essentially equal ones. The next issue here is intention. So naturally, in an organized educational institution like this, we expect the institution and its employees to intend to help you. But that's certainly not true of life in general. Role models are an obvious example. You pick up information about someone who has no intention of helping you. And that doesn't mean they aren't useful. They are. So in a generalized model of learning and teaching, we want to be aware of how many occasions there are where we benefit from someone else, but they didn't mean to. They haven't adapted what they do to help you. Nevertheless, you may benefit from it. So, the second column there is about whether the person you're getting benefit from intends or doesn't intend this. So, for instance, if you're doing an introductory course, you certainly expect the textbook writer to be intending to help you and to have strongly and markedly adapted what they write and how they present it to be of use to you. But in the wider world, you're often picking up information from people who didn't mean to help you. If you're a historian, you look up historic documents, you'll be looking at accounts some manor house steward kept, and the manor house steward certainly wasn't thinking about helping a history researcher later on. Doesn't mean you can't learn from them, but it does mean it won't be adapted to you. And a lot of peer discussion, they're not particularly they're not doing it to help you more than they're doing it to help themselves. Doesn't mean it isn't important and effective. The third issue here expressed in the table is whether there's a personal relationship or not. So if you get an eyeful of Dave Wood in contingent tutoring, you're certainly, or Vygotsky, you're certainly thinking about extremely personal relationships involved in learning and teaching. But there's plenty of impersonal ones. So textbook writers don't know you personally. Shakespeare wasn't writing for you. Anonymous peer review, it's not a personal relationship, although they're acting deliberately. They're all combinations. The table attempts to give you examples of all combinations of these issues. And my wider purpose here is to make you think about the fuller range of what benefits learners. If it's not personal, of course, it can't be contingent. So a textbook writer may intend to help you, but doesn't know you personally and can't do anything specially for you. And the fourth thing mentioned here, and which is represented by the presence or absence of a plus sign in the body of the table, this is about whether the activity is initiated by the other person or is initiated by the learner. Is the learner proactive in this? So there's a sense in which I put on these lectures and you either turn up or not. It's about me being proactive, but if you send an email to your tutor, you're initiating something there. If you organise your own study group, you're the one who's been proactive. Now, that leads on to this slightly different question, not about who the learner's getting help from, but who's organising the activities in the Lorillard sense. So, another thing I derived from the Lorillard model, but which isn't in it, is to consider the Lorillard model is about activities, about learning or acquiring the content. But more and more, in thinking about who's active, who initiates these activities, I think about an image of that model with another layer hovering about it, and above each of Lorillard's 12 activities, it's eventually possible for me to think about how that activity might be about who takes the management decisions, that is, who does the organisation. And it's just a very simple aspect of that about who initiates one of the activities. So this would come up, for instance, in studies of peer-assisted learning groups or whatever, or recording what students say to each other. And the most common things are often really management questions. You know, most common thing for two students in the class to ask each other is, when's the deadline? What do they mean by this word in the essay question? What kind of exam is it? All of these are admin questions or management questions. They're not about explaining the content. So this is clearly a very important part of actual learning and teaching. And there's questions about who organises and how it gets organised. Of course, quite a lot of the management is out of the hands of university staff. Essentially, it's about how many hours the student decides to allocate to study as a whole or to study of a particular module, so on and so forth. So, on the main course page, somewhere near the bottom, there's a link to an essay I wrote a while ago describing this concept of a management layer, so you could get a few pages expansion there. Now, I'm talking about it here because there's some interaction between management and object layers. And the table we've just been looking at illustrates that. So, although I think it's a useful conceptual step to distinguish between what I'm calling management and object or content layers, in many practical manifestations you get some of each. In particular, if you think back to the description of contingent tutoring, where in Dave Wood's case the tutor was giving step-by-step feedback to the learner, and as a child tried to solve the wooden puzzle in front of them, I think it's important to realise that as well as the overt prompts about the content, like suggestions that lead to the child doing something different for the next action, the tutor as a whole is holding the whole occasion together. They're making sure it ultimately comes out as a success. They're supporting its meaning and making many decisions about what kind of prompt, and as well as supplying some content knowledge. So the contingent tutoring model is a model of an activity where these two layers are very intimately mixed together. Now, I thought I'd suggest you some ideas that have only emerged for me more recently. If you explore the educational literature on peer-co interaction, you frequently see the terms cooperation and collaboration, and they're usually used as contrasts to each other. But I've lost faith in using those terms because, well, first of all, if you look in the dictionary and you try to work out etymologically what they mean, they don't really they both mean working together in some vague sense. So they're not useful for a distinction. And what's more, I believe authors not only usually fail to give a definition, but they don't mean the same thing as each other. Nevertheless, there are important distinctions between different ways in which peers interact. And here, there's three there, but actually there are four. So here's some distinctions which I think are important when you're trying to analyse particular kinds of peer interaction in a learning context. So the first is to make a distinction between joint versus reciprocal benefits. So if you club together with someone to put up a two-person tent when you're camping, that's a joint benefit. You both want to be in the same tent, and it's easier if there are two of you. So that's a joint benefit. Or you've got the same kind of benefit, and you'll both suffer if it doesn't happen. You'll both be rewarded if it does. A quite different kind of benefit is a reciprocal, what I'm going to call a reciprocal one, which is what you get whenever you purchase or something or barter it. That is, if you sell your old textbook to a student, you get money, they get the textbook. Those are utterly different, they don't overlap in any way, the kind of benefit. And I think the studies by Miyake and Howe on the nature of what she called constructive interaction, the nature of conceptual discussions that benefit both parties, are actually, when you look at the details, they're not joint, they're not actually constructing the same understanding as each other. You're doing something which, on the whole, benefits both of you, but the benefits are separate in detail. And I'd call that reciprocal benefit. The same with reciprocal peer critiquing, where two students read and comment on each other's work. There's very strong evidence that both benefit, but the benefits aren't identical. It's well worth them doing it, because they can be pretty confident they'll benefit. In fact, if you just review someone else's work and they don't review yours, you will benefit from doing the review. And your benefit will be separate from their benefit. So there are important cases in peer interaction of reciprocal rather than joint benefit. Now, when we consider the kind of group work inflicted by people like me on classes of students, they're essentially one important kind of group work is where there's a joint product, where you're required to produce a single thing together. And that joint product is different from cases like Miyake's conversation, where you benefit from discussing conceptual development, but the benefit is private. That is, you go away with an improved understanding, but it's not identical, and it doesn't depend on the other person's understanding. It is usefully stimulated both by your efforts to say things to them and by your internal response to the things they say. Those are two different setups. And why does that matter? Well, if you think hard about, even better if you get some data, if you look at a group of people who have to make a joint decision, say, like a family agreeing where to go on holiday, that's a joint product kind of thing. They have to come up with a decision. They don't have to all understand the same things about the decision. And in fact, in the most common cases outside universities of groups working together, is they'll deliberately be composed of people with different specialities. So you may all have to produce a joint report, but you don't have to understand why the other person contributed what they contributed necessarily. Or more likely, it's not so much a joint report as to get something done. And then in fact, it's a real pleasure to be working with someone who is happy and expert at doing the things you hate, but doesn't like doing what you can contribute, so that you feel pleased with your contribution, you'll feel pleased that they're on the whole grateful, and you're pleased not to have to do your share of the bit you hate. Now, that's typical of a joint product, and that is a very efficient way of getting things done by specialization of roles. It's actually a very bad way to learn things, because the group doesn't have to explain to each other why they're doing what they're doing. They probably do a bit of that, but the whole point about having another expert there is you might like to listen to their 5-minute explanation, but you're under no illusion that you have anything like the full understanding of why they made the choices they did. So if there's a joint product, it actually is not a group structure that maximizes learning. What maximizes learning is things like the constructive interaction that Miyake does, where you're not obliged to agree about things, but you do benefit from listening to the things they say and allowing that to trigger different thoughts. Third kind of distinction that can be important here. This is a terrible phrase, but what I mean is that people can be cooperating at different levels. So they might be a cooperation at the level of the general aim, that is, you're determined to support drug addicts, say, and you go about it in different ways, but what you agree about is the overall aim, not necessarily about any of the actions. A bit more specific would be agreeing a specific goal, like, opening a rehab centre. So you cooperate on the goal, but you'll probably divide up the actions between you. On the other hand, there can be other things which are focusing around joint action. And I suppose a mob is probably really like that. That is, mobs are notoriously volatile. They can shift the aim of what they're doing from chanting to fighting or whatever it is, and they all do it together. They like acting together. They're not so fussed about the goal. What they like is the action together. So people can interact cooperatively but be actually pinned in at different levels, and keeping an eye on that can be important to understanding, or at least to categorizing what's going on. And fourthly, there's an issue I'm not very familiar and at ease with, about community and identity. Now, there's quite a literature, educational literature, on, they sometimes call it communities of learning or learning in the community. So one example in the literature, old literature, is or was about Xerox photocopier technicians. So these are people who have to go out, fix photocopies at different clients, but their learning is often about sharing war stories. So when they get together, they describe the problems they met, the problems they solved, the problems they didn't solve. They share knowledge. And that's knowledge based on a community of practice. Their practice is fixing these copiers. The sharing is at a knowledge level. A lot of that literature, though, has the tone that that's the ideal, that's what humans do naturally and best, that organized educational institutions ought to be organizing things so it happens like that. That's much less clear to me. Might take the opposite view, that that's what people do when the learning is disorganized, not what's optimal. But you'll certainly see a large literature on that. The other part of that identity is that, well, first of all, people who share a practice probably take part of their identity from the job they're doing. For instance, being a photocopier technician. Why does that matter? Well, I don't fully understand this, but a friend of mine I was talking to at a conference not long ago has a large project attempting to improve things by sharing knowledge of that kind between practitioners, and they in particular were focusing on a community of midwives. And one of the issues that came up is, are midwives prepared, in fact, to share critical experiences, which may, of course, typically about awkward things which people might criticize them for? And it became quite clear they would probably be induced to share it with other midwives, but they weren't going to let the doctors see it, because they didn't feel they had remotely the same professional identity as doctors, and therefore they didn't trust them, therefore they didn't want this sort of chat room with those bastards in it. So that's the kind of thing, is that when you've got the idea that peer interaction could be really useful for learning, but it's a group of more than two people, then there's issues of trust, and the question is, where does trust come from? And identity is somehow tied up with that. So very recently, and not unconnected with the coursework for this course, is a few thoughts I've been having with a postgrad of mine about how to extend the Miyake and how kind of conversation to multi-person ones, because the empirical studies I've seen have all actually been about two-person interactions, and other issues occur when you start thinking seriously about multi-person ones. So Sarah's had good experience with academic collaborators in Google Docs, which, given the trouble with and with Moodle, I suggested. But the most exciting thing going on at the moment, apparently, is something called FedWiki, which is about a different kind of wiki software, which is, in my view, is not really so much about producing joint products, but it's more about what it takes to have enjoyable, unstructured, impromptu interactions, but over technology rather than face-to-face, in a group larger than two. If you Google FedWiki, you'll find it, but there's not a lot written about it at the moment. But it's a real attempt to produce a different style of blog where all kinds of sharing can be done, where you can take copies of other people's stuff, mutate them, use them as your own, or comment on them. All kinds of things are supposed to be equally possible. And that goes, I think, with the impromptu shifting of benefit from day to day in a group of people discussing it. And partly repeating what I've said a moment ago, some other issues come into play. So the thing from social psychology I think is important to remember in education is that, contrary to almost all our intuitions, including those who should know better because they've lectured on social psychology, actually the evidence is that if you force people to work together, then they become bonding, at least if it's successful, and particularly if the task was imposed on them externally. Most of us feel emotionally. We have to know them first before we can possibly cooperate with them. But that's actually not what the psychology says. And interacting with this is a question of whether identity is created as part of a group, or is it a precondition for it to work well, like the midwives. So don't show I haven't thought through all of that. And even more interestingly is whether strong social bonds, what relationship do they have to learning? So actually I think one of the things that real academics and researchers somehow acquire during their training and so on is that, although it's more enjoyable to talk with people you like, it's not necessary. You can learn just as much by reacting against what people say, or by people who have no pleasant personal characteristics but say things which make you go away and think more. And the last thing I'll say, because it's a pointer to a literature that may resolve this if I've worked on it a bit more, is it's related to this. I think, and I will certainly put it there if it's not, I think it's on the list if you want to look it up. Someone called Bales, publishing in the 1950s. I know this because a friend of mine used Bales categories to analyze some transcripts from an educational experiment. But Bales's data was from American business meetings. And one of the things that's so surprising to a cognitivist like me is that half of his categories, and therefore probably about half the data in a sample like that, were to do with someone in the group saying something, not new content, but saying something to change other people in the group's view about the weight they should put on it. So something like, you don't want to listen to Steve when he bangs on about the social stuff, but you might want to trust him about the cognitive stuff. And interestingly, I've picked up a few comments like that from studies of children in school who apparently have if it's a school which encourages peer collaboration, they have an acute sense that if you want your maths fixed, talk to John, but don't listen to anything he says in history. So this is not new. This seems to be really general human mechanism, and it seems to take up a lot of staff in groups, a lot of space and speech acts in groups larger than two, is changing other people's ideas about the amount of authority or weight to give to what a given person says. It's important to us, and a lot of work in groups seems to be done by it, and that is a bit like what I was saying about meta-information in Perry about who knows best, how much should you trust. But I have to say that when you have these free talking groups, although some will have the time of their life and think it's tremendously productive, there's probably at least a few people in the same group who'll think this is rubbish and leave. So it's not like a cozy recipe that, if done reasonably correctly, everybody will enjoy. It's groups larger than two get into this who's in, who's out, and stuff like that. which I think is related to Bale's categories. It's related to the way that social interactions include these unpleasant, from a cozy perspective, unpleasant processes, that clearly that's part of human nature, and clearly it will be important in trying to deliberately design productive versions of multi-person intellectual exchanges. So there's my latest thoughts about what I haven't solved but know is a problem. Okay, that's the end of today.